One of the things as Christians I think we could probably do a little better at is telling our stories. We have corporate stories as Christians that we ought to tell and retell and pass down to younger believers. And by stories, I really mean histories, things that can be well told, though. Some of these should be Bible stories, but we also have 2,000 years of church history, and a whole lot's happened in them. It's replete with important stories worth passing down. Testimonies of prior Christians, what we can learn, for example, from the Baptist Encyclopedia. It's a set of books in the 1800s that just have little biographies on a whole host of people that did lots of tremendous things that have mostly been forgotten. But there's stories there. Stories in the Baptist Book of Martyrs. Stories behind these hymns that we sing, like Amazing Grace. There's an entire book about the man that wrote Amazing Grace, and it's a moving thing to learn of his life, and it's a story worth telling. How God blessed and built a particular local church, or on a more personal level, a story of God's hand in your life that could be handed down to your children and your grandchildren. We're going to look at Psalm 114 today. This is part of the Jewish Hallel. The Hallel are the collection of six psalms that start with 113 and go through 118. I want to look specifically at Psalm 114. This was one of their ways of telling their corporate stories, and they would tell them frequently. The Hallel was essentially combined into a long prayer where all they did was recite those six psalms. They had them memorized in Hebrew. We'll do the Lord's Supper later. When Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, it very clearly says they sang a hymn. I can tell you specifically, they likely preached or sang Psalms 113 to 118 in the Hebrew from memory. And this was done frequently and especially at the so-called pilgrim feast where people would travel to Jerusalem for a feast, specifically Passover, Pentecost that we read about in Acts 2, and the Feast of Tabernacles. You do it as part of that celebration, and you may even recite it on the way in the journey. It becomes part of your corporate story. It teaches the children, and it's done every year so that it would be reinforced. It reminds them as worshipers afresh of what God had done for them. And Psalm 114 is unique among them, and you'll see it when we look at how it is written. But it is a story, but it's also a history that needs to be taught, needs to be handed down. When God delivered his people from bondage out of Egypt, they became, he will say in this psalm, God's sanctuary and God's dominion. Look at Psalm 114, just that first and second verse. When Israel went out of Egypt, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language, Judah was his sanctuary and Israel his dominion. What's interesting about this entire psalm is it never says what God did directly. That is, we're used to reading something that says, God did this and God said that. This whole psalm is written from the perspective of the reaction to what God did. And so we're told in that first verse that Israel went out of Egypt. Now, we know God led them out of Egypt through a man named Moses, but he doesn't want to focus on this from that perspective. He wants to reverse the sort of the picture and look at it from a different angle. How does the creation respond when God moves in a profound and supernatural way? That's how the psalm will be written. So he references for our background a story that, especially in a Jewish culture, they would well know that they left Egypt. Israel went out of Egypt. It left Egypt. They were slaves there, and they left that bondage. The house of Jacob, just another expression, you know, from a people of a strange language. What's a strange language? You heard the expression, it's all Greek to me. They could have said, it's all Egyptian to me, right? A strange language means a foreign language that they don't understand. So in essence, the people are talking unintelligibly because it's not their native tongue. This Egyptian language was a constant reminder they're not home. Constant reminder for the people in bondage those 400 years. They are strangers in a strange land. They are isolated, and at least apart from God leading them out, they're hopeless. This situation wasn't getting better. It started off pretty good, but people in due time forgot about Joseph and what he had done both for Egypt and for his family. And before long, you've got new pharaohs, new people, And the Jewish people are just in bondage. They're just slaves, and it's just getting worse and worse, and the work hours and the conditions and so forth. So a situation of hopelessness, and yet it says Israel went out. You know, and it didn't, it's not like they went out paupers, right? They went out rich. That's how God worked it. You had a group of people that wouldn't let them go, and they had to pay them to go before God was through humiliating the Pharaoh. But he doesn't say anything about that. He just says they went out. Verse 2, Judah was his. That's obviously God's sanctuary. What's a sanctuary? You know, a sanctuary usually is a holy place. This word is translated almost every time in the Old Testament, and it is common. It's simply holy. Holiness. That's it. That's how it's usually. Here and there, it'll be translated as a sanctuary because the context demands some idea that it's a place, but it is holiness. Judah was God's holiness. That's what it's saying there. And Israel was God's dominion. That word is almost always translated as rule, right? The right to rule, the kingdom, that sort of idea. This is coming from Exodus 19. You know, the psalm is telling a story, but the Jewish people understand this is from the book of Exodus. You've got a big book, but what if you told the story a little differently? That book's very detailed. It's got all the facts and dates, so to say, but I want to tell it in a way that takes the reader, takes the listener, takes the young child that's on this pilgrimage. You know, we read that Jesus, when he was 12 years old, went to the Passover with his parents. You realize that Joseph taught Jesus this song, and they would have recited it there together as a family. And so it's how do you tell the story in a way that pulls the reader into it so it's not just an old date and fact that doesn't seem important? Why do I need to know that? Why do I have to take history class? It's real and it's fresh and it's vibrant and in all those good things. That's the goal of the psalmist here. And so he says, you know, Judah was God's holiness and Israel, God's kingdom, God's dominion. Exodus 19, I'm going to start reading in the first verse, but I really want to let you hear a passage I think you have heard before. It's Exodus 19:6. Exodus 19 says, in the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt. So that gets our setting. Same setting as this psalm. When they were out of Egypt, the same day came into the wilderness, they came into the wilderness of Sinai, for they were departed from Rephidim and were come to the desert of Sinai and had pitched in the wilderness. And there Israel camped before the mount, that's Mount Sinai. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and now how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And this is the verse I want you to see. This really what the psalmist wants to capture about the Exodus. You shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, that's dominion, and a holy nation. That's the sanctuary. That's the part of the psalm is capturing. It wasn't just that he got some group of people out of jail, out of slavery. He's making them a new people. And I realize there's a genesis to this back in the life of Abraham, and he said, I'll make you a nation. But really, you know, he told Abraham, that nation isn't going to be now. There's going to be this 400-year delay. The time of some of the Gentiles isn't ripe yet, and so it's a far off from Abraham, but now you move to the Exodus, and God is really bringing this people together, and he does it with style. He brings them out rich. He gives them a bunch of stuff, and of course, he'll go on the mountain and give Moses this law, but he's making them a people, not just a nation, a holy nation, and not just a people, but a kingdom of priests. And so this little Psalm 114 recalls that because that's important. That makes their identity different than so many other nations, perhaps all the other nations. Very few nations can really say they were founded on principles of God like Israel can, and to some degree our country, but they were a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. When God made the people his sanctuary, what was the response? You know, God is at work all the time. And we call that providence. His hand is at work. But there are times when something extraordinary happens in the sense that God intervenes in human history in a miraculous and obvious and a public way that no one can deny. And the psalmist doesn't want to say what God did, but how this world responded to his intervention. And that's what you read in verse 3, Psalm 114:3. The sea saw it. And what did it see? God pulled a group of people from bondage, from the most powerful king on the planet, and he made them a holy nation and a kingdom of priests. And as it were, in nature, the sea, I wonder which sea saw it, the sea observed what God did. And the Jordan River, it says, was driven back. You know, the sea observed the entirety of verses 1 and 2. And what did the sea do in response to observing verses 1 and 2? It says clearly in verse 3 here, the sea fled. It fled. You know, it doesn't say God made it flee. God intervenes and the world just backs away from him. That's the picture he wants to show us. And the sea flees from God, as does the Jordan River. When did the sea flee from God? We read it in Exodus chapter 14 in verse 21. It says, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. That's, of course, the Red Sea. And the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. That's Exodus 14:21, a passage we know about where God splits the Red Sea. But from the psalmist's perspective here, God brings his people, and God is manifested at that moment in that locale on the planet, and the Red Sea just flees away from God so that God can walk through with his people through on dry land. And that's the imagery. And then the Jordan River, that's much later. When they're through the wilderness, and we know there's a lot of history there. There's a generation that dies in the wilderness and a next generation that comes up, and they're the ones that are going to cross the Jordan River, and they're going to get over there, and the first obstacle they're going to come to is Jericho. And who's going to lead them in battle? Well, you read the book of Joshua, and it's the captain of the Lord's host, what we would call a pre-incarnate manifestation of Jesus Christ. And you know, there's Joshua surveying Jericho, and he sees someone coming up to him, looks like a soldier, and he says, well, whose army are you with? And he says, you know, mine or Jericho's. And he says, I'm the captain of God's army. You're standing on holy ground. He says to him what he said to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3, take your shoes off. Amen. You're on holy ground. So, you know, all this history, you can't tell it on a few lines, but you can bring it to memory as you characterize it in this way. And the audience remembers what God did. And it all started with looking over the river of impossibility in faith, seeing Jericho on the other side, and walking across a dry river, not because of the river, but because of the promises on the other side, right? Not held back by the river of impossibility. And as they move forward with God at the lead, and they have the Ark of the Covenant there, the waters, they spread back for miles. And you read that in Joshua chapter 3 and verse 15 and 16. As they that bear the Ark, that's the Ark of the Covenant, were come unto Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bear the ark were dipped in the brim of the water. I mean, the moment the pinky toe touched the water, it's gone. All their faith required was touching that water. After that, God moves it, right? But from the psalmist's perspective, he doesn't say God moved it. He says that river got up and ran. It's a different way of telling the story. They bear the ark, and they were dipped in the brim of the water, for Jordan overfloweth all his banks all the time of harvest. So this isn't, someone might say, well, this was the time of year where you can go to that one part of the river and you can, like, you know, you step like a foot across it. Now I'm on the east side. Now I'm on the west side. It wasn't that. The river was flooded, right? And so he says that the Jordan overflowed so that the waters which came down from above stood and rose as upon a heap very far from the city Adam, that is beside Zeratan, and those that came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea, that's the Dead Sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. The water just moves for miles, and the psalmist says, Jordan was driven back. That's how he reminds them of this story. God did not have to fight back the Red Sea. He did not have to fight back the Jordan River. His mere presence caused the elements of nature to run. Fear caused the elements of nature to run away. They are personified as people, the soldiers of the world that would stand against God and his people. A new order is being formed, a group of people, the holy nation, the kingdom of priests. And as this new order is being brought to the Holy Land, nature can only retreat. This occurs when God directly intervenes in history. More happens. Look in verse 4. It's not only the river, not only the sea, but the mountains and the hills. Verse 4 says, the mountains skipped like rams. That little word skipped, if you go and look in a concordance, it's translated almost everywhere as dancing. The mountains just danced away like rams. The little hills, the implication is they danced away as well, like lambs. Again, doesn't say what God does. It says how the nature responds to God's intervention. The river has fled. The sea has fled. Even the mountains and the hills are running from God. What has happened? This is a poetic description of what, in the modern vernacular, we call an earthquake. It likely refers to Mount Sinai and the region around there. I'll read you something from Exodus 19 and verse 18. It says in Exodus 19, 18, and Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke. And is you see the smoke descending from the top, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. It was a physical manifestation of God. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. You know, in connection with God giving this holy nation and kingdom of priests a law, a collection of doctrine that would tell them what holiness looks like in a practical way in day-to-day life. He gives them what we sometimes call the Law of Moses, the Torah, and he gives this on Mount Sinai, and there's this quaking. Why is it quaking? Because God is there. You know, it's interesting, there's a place in the Gospels where Jesus basically said, you know, if I didn't have some witnesses here, it was at the triumphal entry, the rocks would cry out. When God manifests himself, the hills skip or dance. And that's a reference to the earthquake event that happens there. Deborah, one of the, you know, Barak was the judge, but he didn't have the spine for his job, it would seem. And a woman took care of a business in Judges 5. And Deborah has a song she sings. It's a very good song. It's essentially a psalm. And she recounts God's goodness in bringing them into the Holy Land. And when she sings her song in Judges 5, in verse 4, she says, Lord, when thou wentest out of Seir, when thou marchest out of the field of Edom, the earth trembled. When God walks, the earth trembles. Earthquakes happen. And the heavens dropped, and the clouds also dropped water. The mountains melted from before the Lord, even that Sinai from before the Lord God of Israel. The mountains quake when God's there. See, it's not usually real hard to figure out if God's on the mountain, by the way. Each element did what that which is contrary to nature. The sea is not designed to split and leave an open area of dry land. The river is designed to run one direction. Rivers don't usually run the other direction. And mountains, by their very nature, don't usually move. They certainly don't stand up and dance in the presence of God, which is the imagery he gives. So we see this miraculous thing. Why? Because God's establishing a new order from the people of Israel, a holy nation, and a kingdom of priests. The vivid descriptions, the events that we read surrounding this nation being established, are designed to make it vivid in the minds of a new audience who wasn't there. It's so easy for history to be just history, something that happened centuries ago, and it's not vibrant and fresh today, and it's not changing me today. but it should. And the way to do that is to tell the stories in a vivid way and to pass them down. And that's why I said earlier, I think Christians haven't done as good of a job of this as Jews. We're a little too concerned about there being a ritual. There's nothing wrong with a ritual. It's a hard attitude that goes along with it. Some stories need to be retold. We all have some stories we retell, but sometimes we don't retell really the ones that we ought to. I mean, I retell frequently with my children, you know, like the day they were born. We would talk about it, and all these things happen because, you know, like with my first one, there was a fire truck right outside the window. Somehow the fire alarm went off in the hospital at the time. So just things happen, and you tell the story. But what about the stories that have eternal consequence? See, they're passing along the stories here. There's great value, I think, in remembering what God's done with a sense of awe. Great value because the stories bind Israel as a nation. They're designed to be retold, told to the children. And the imagery, the personification of mountains and rivers and so forth, presents history for a new generation to experience it something like the way the people that were there experienced it. Because they're there, they don't see God physically present, they just see the river running. They just see the sea running. And the mountains shaking. And so from the point of observation, it's fresh. You know, this is true of all the great acts of redemption in the Bible. It's not just what he did in Israel. The greatest acts were accompanied by supernatural changes as nature responds to God's intervention. And I give you some examples. God will deliver, as we've been studying in the Sunday morning series, Noah and his family from a global judgment. What do you read when that judgment begins? Because when he begins it, he safely tucked Noah and his family in that ark. Genesis chapter 7 and verse 6 says, Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. And Noah went in and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him into the ark because of the waters of the flood. They're in safety. The faith they had was to be in the ship, and they are. There were of clean beasts and of beasts that are not clean and of fowls and of everything that creepeth upon the earth. There went in two and two unto Noah into the ark, the male and the female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass, after 7 days, the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, history, dates, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up. That's an earthquake. That's how all this happened. People think of it as a flood, and of course we know it rained, but it's the upheaval of all the land. This was a tremendous earthquake. It was probably the second worst earthquake that will ever have occurred. We'll read about another one in a moment. But it changed the topography of the planet. Why? Because God was in the ship with Noah, right? I mean, that's what happened. And nature responded. God has redeemed people who trust Christ from sin. And it happened, the critical historical event happened, in Jesus' early earthly ministry. We read in Matthew 27, and I'm going to start in verse 50, but I want you to see how the planet responded to God intervening in history in a supernatural way. Matthew 27, verse 50, Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. This is at the point where the Son of God has finished paying for the sins of the world. In John's gospel, it has a phrase that we don't see here, it is finished. Single word in the Greek, but it is finished. And then he cried again with a loud voice, he yielded up the ghost, and behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. And the earth did quake and the rocks rent. God intervening in history in a supernatural way, an extraordinary way, to do something that's redemptive, which he does when Christ dies. He's paid for the sins of the world, and the earth quakes, and the graves were opened up. Graves don't usually give our dead back to us. Everything has been twisted around because of the presence of God. Rivers don't usually run upstream. Seas don't divide in two, and graves don't give the dead folk back, but they did this day because of God's presence, of his working through Christ. Graves were opened and many bodies of the saints. You notice who, by the way, the saints, not as anybody, which slept arose. Now I got to wonder, we never told, like, how long were they gone? Is this a saint who had been gone 100 years? We don't know. I suspect that's possible. But I know there were some people who had been to funerals and they were remembering their dead loved ones. And then just you'd like to be a fly on the wall when that person knocks on the door. Right? I mean, just an incredible thing. But when God intervenes, things like that happen. Things that ain't natural happen because he's not bound by natural laws. They came out of the graves after his resurrection. They went into the holy city, that's Jerusalem. They appeared unto many. This wasn't done in secret. Now, when the centurion and they were with him watching Jesus, these are his Roman guards, saw the earthquake, they knew that was from God. See, that earthquake's convicting that this is a manifestation of the power of God. And those things which were done, dead folks walking out of the graveyard, they feared greatly. I'd be too. I'd be hiding, right? These aren't zombies, though. These are people that have been resurrected. They look just like they did when they were alive and well. Truly, they say, this is their testimony, truly this was the Son of God. See, God has intervened in history, and he did it again in Matthew 28. Why? He delivered people from sin when Jesus died. He gave them new life when he resurrected. And so you continue reading, you bump over to Matthew 28. Now God's going to intervene in human history in yet another way because this man, Jesus, prosecuted as a blasphemer, God has fully vindicated and he raises him from the dead. Matthew 28:1, in the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, in other words, when it's Sunday, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher, and behold, there was a great earthquake. There it is. Why? Man ain't dead no more. God has manifested himself. He has intervened in human history in a dramatic way, and the nature has responded. It has shaked. The hills have skipped, and the mountains have danced before God, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning, his raiment white as snow, and for fear of him the keepers did shake and became as dead men. God put his own guard on the grave. They didn't need no Roman centurion anymore. And the angel answered and said unto the women, fear not ye, for I know that you seek Jesus, which was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen. And as he said, come, see the place where the Lord lay. So God intervening in history, raising Jesus. Well, when God delivered and established his people, the great changes in creation, they were necessary. They must respond to the presence of God. But they're not entirely expected, and that's why there's a story to tell the next generation, look what God did, and look how the world, the planet, responded. Verse 5 of Psalm 114 says, what ailed thee, O thou sea? Now you've got the sea and the mountains and the river personified, and so the psalmist is going to talk to them and taunt them. He's going to taunt them. He's going to ask the rhetorical question, why'd you run? Why did you run? And of course, the reason is to tell to the reader, of course, to reinforce, they fled because they had to flee, because God was in this. Listen to what he says. What ailed thee, O thou sea? Remember the Red Sea? That thou fleddest. Thou Jordan, that thou wast driven back. You mountains that you skipped like rams, you little hills like lambs. What caused you to dance, he says. And it's a rhetorical question because we know why God was there. These rhetorical questions of interrogation personify elements of nature, but they reflect the excitement of the person observing the changes as they occurred. And you try to take that moment that you don't have a video of it, you don't have a painting of it, but you try to bring it forward to be experienced again. The sea, the river, the mountains, and the hills, they can't answer. The questions help the audience know how nature must respond to the presence of the Lord. It's language designed so that the listeners feel like the event just happened that moment or that day. And the natural elements are called to the witness stand to testify as to what God had done, a taunt against them. They fled because the Creator intervened to prepare a new order, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation by supernatural means. When the Lord God supernaturally changes nature and making his people his sanctuary, and that's what it said in that first verse, the world should tremble. That's the natural reaction. That's the natural response. The earth now, look in verse 7, is instructed to tremble before God. Tremble thou earth, the psalmist says, 114 verse 7. Tremble thou earth at the presence of the Lord. That's all it takes. At the presence of the Lord. At the presence of the God of Jacob, verse 8, which turned the rock into a standing water, the flint into a fountain of waters. The questions that went before, the rhetorical questions in verses 5 and 6, they lay the groundwork for a command to the whole planet to tremble before God because he's not through working with Israel. And so they have to tremble before him. God was present, supernaturally caring for his people. The planet must respect that and run. Something new was unfolding from the Exodus to the occupation of the Holy Land. This new order is breaking in on the old natural world. Supernatural events are happening, and they witness what God's doing with his people. God's power to change nature is demonstrated in bringing water from a rock. This happened in the Exodus. You know, you realize they're in the desert. We kind of know that, but you got to go be in a desert for a little while. I went to a place called Palm Springs, not in Florida, but in California, and they told me it wasn't that hot that day. It was like 112 degrees. That ain't hot. When it's hot, it's 124. I needed to walk about a half a mile. I normally walk several miles. I thought I wasn't going to make it. All right, there was no service station on the way where I could go get a gallon of water. You don't have to be long in a real desert to realize the necessity of water. And of course, water is life in essence. That's why you meet the woman at the well in John 4, and she's going to that well every day. So in Exodus 17, they're whining. You know, Moses, you brought us out here. Where's the water fountain, right? And Exodus 17, 5, the Lord said unto Moses, go before the people and take with thee the elders of Israel and thy rod. Remember, he's got the rod that budded. Wherewith thou smotest the river. Take in thine hand and go, and behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. God can make it so that rivers run and hills dance, and a rock can be touched with a stick, and water will flow in abundance and feed a nation. And so this is the reason that the psalmist says the earth ought to tremble. If he can do all of that, they should tremble before what he's doing through the nation Israel. Prior to the conquest, God showed his power to fulfill all their needs because he is sovereign over nature and over people. And I tell you, one day, the Lord will redeem his people from bondage of this world, all his people. This looks forward, not just about Israel, but when he says for the whole earth to tremble, he looks forward to something in the future when God brings all of his plans for his people to fruition. I want to read you something from Revelation chapter 16. Revelation 16. In the Revelation, as Jesus is about to return to receive what is his, the whole planet basically is his, and he's receiving it. But in the imagery of the Revelation, he has a seal. Let's say, a sealed document. And the document's given to him in Revelation 5, and it has seven seals on it. And as he removes the seven seals, things happen. It's a legal document. God has provided to Jesus, handed him this book, the title deed to the universe. He begins to remove the legal seals. Only Jesus can do this, by the way. They're God's seals. I can't remove them, and you can't. The Son of God can. But as he removes them, great judgments fall on the planet. And as he removes the seventh seal, that's the big one, there's these seven judgments that are called trumpet judgments. And as you get to the seventh of the trumpet judgments, there's the seven bowl or vial, V-I-A-L, judgments. And it's that part of this. We're at the very end of this sequence of judgments when Jesus is about to return, as he does in Revelation 19. And it's there that we read that the seventh angel, this is the last one, this is the worst and the final and the last of God's temporal wrath on a people that thought they could take God on and beat him. And he does it. The seventh angel poured out his vial, that's a bowl, into the air. And there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, it is done. That sounds a lot like what happened when Jesus was on the cross and he paid for the sins of the world. It's finished. And now the judgment's finished with this one final bowl. There were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake. God is here on this planet again. And as he has done before, as it happened when he was at Mount Sinai, and as it's happened many other times, and as it happened in the days of Noah, a great earthquake. But this is worse than the global flood of Noah. Such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. The final recognition that God is moving in a divine and supernatural way. The great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine and the fierceness of his wrath. He crushes Babylon, the symbolic symbol of evil throughout all time, the seat of Satan, as it were, and God deals with him. And this trembling comes with it. And verse 20 says, every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. Why? They danced away, just like they did in Psalm 114. And there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was succeeding great. Well, we leave Psalm 114 with this in mind. What is your story? Have you thought through how to tell your personal story memorably, your testimony, what God has done for you? And even beyond bringing you to Christ, what else has he done in your life that was, you know, so significant and such a pivotal moment in life for you as God did this? There's a story, and we have them, and these are the stories that need to be told to our fellow Christians. They need to be handed down. This was something common in the Psalms. They would go to the temple, and they would offer God a peace offering, and they would publicly proclaim what God had done for them, and that way tell their story, and it can become someone else's story too, and they can remember, look what God did in this person's life. Sometimes we as Christians need to stop along life's road and look back, as it were, although it might have been a winding and a sort of a steep climb for us, and we can see how, though looking back, how God's faithfulness directed us. We should look back at things like the deliverances God has given us, the way in which he led us, the blessings he's bestowed at different times, the victories he's won for us, the encouragement he's given, sometimes through people around us that God puts in our lives, and he gives us this encouragement. When we face difficulties, we might forget God's past faithfulness, but that's why we need the stories. Those stories are the reason to have confidence about the future when things sometimes seem uncertain. And we need to look back. We can see the joy of victory, the challenge of the climb along the way, the presence of your traveling companion who is God himself, of for whom the mountains tremble. He's promised never to leave you nor forsake you. Jesus says that right in Matthew. That means something. Well, you have a story about God's deliverance that's personal to you. You need to tell it. But this time, we're going to be moving into the Lord's Supper, if we can have the ushers come.